Imagine taking this like totally bloated 100 megabyte native application, and you just strip away 99.8% of its file size.
Mm.
You completely bypass the Apple and Google app stores, and somehow, like against all logic, you actually increase user engagement.
Yeah, it sounds made up.
Right. But that is not hypothetical. That is literally exactly what Starbucks did when they replaced their traditional mobile app with a progressive web app.
And, you know, they are definitely not an outlier either. I mean, you look at Pinterest and their metrics are just as jarring.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They rolled out a progressive web app and saw like a 60% increase in core user engagements. It just completely flips the script on how we even think about mobile software distribution.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because, you know, for everyone listening, you've probably heard the acronym PWA thrown around constantly in tech circles.
Constant.
But the actual mechanics of what it is remain notoriously misunderstood. So today, our mission for this deep dive is built around this incredibly detailed piece of source material. It's a guide from Scopic titled Building Progressive Web Apps, Concept to Deployment Guide.
It's a great read.
It really is. We are going to look under the hood to answer one fundamental question for you. Are progressive web apps the ultimate shortcut to a unified, frictionless mobile presence? Or, you know, are they just this overhyped compromise that fundamentally alienates iPhone users?
Which is arguably like one of the most polarized debates in software architecture right now.
Totally.
You have developers who treat PWAs as the open web's ultimate rebellion against the app store monopolies. But then you have product managers who view them as this really risky second tier experience.
So let's start with the mechanics. Because before we can even debate the strategy or the massive cost implications, which we will get to, we need to know what separates a PWA from just, you know, a really well-designed, responsive website. What makes it progressive?
Right. So to understand the architecture, you really have to look at the three foundational pillars that make a PWA function.
Okay.
First, the entire application must be served over HTTPS. That is a hard, non-negotiable technical requirement built right into the modern browser ecosystem.
Well, wait, I mean, I know HTTPS is standard practice for the modern web anyway, right? But why is it a strict technical gatekeeper here? Like, what actually breaks if I try to run a PWA on an unencrypted connection?
The security risk just becomes astronomical. And to understand why, you kind of have to jump to the third pillar of a PWA, which is the service worker.
Okay, the service worker. What is that exactly?
So a service worker is essentially this highly privileged JavaScript file. It acts as a proxy server sitting right between your browser and the network.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it has the power to intercept every single network request your app makes. It can modify responses. It can push background notifications.
That's a lot of power.
Exactly. So if you were running that kind of power over an unencrypted standard HTTP connection, a bad actor could easily execute a man-in-the-middle attack.
Right.
They could hijack the service worker and completely compromise the application indefinitely. So the browser simply will not allow a service worker to even wake up without a secure HTTPS lock.
Okay, I mean, that makes total sense.
Yeah.
You can't give a script that much underlying system power without a verified encrypted line. So we have HTTPS and we have the service worker acting as the brain.
Yep.
What's the missing piece? You said there were three pillars.
The web app manifest. This is it's a JSON file that basically acts as the UI instruction manual for the browser.
Okay.
It tells the device exactly how the app should behave when it's installed. So it dictates the high resolution icons for the home screen, the splash screen colors, and critically whether the app should launch in standalone mode.
Standalone mode.
Yeah, standalone mode is crucial because it physically strips away the browser's address bar and the navigation buttons.
Oh, so it hides the fact that it's a browser.
Exactly. It forces the web app to look and feel exactly like a native sandboxed application.
So pulling that all together, that's where the term progressive enhancement comes in, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I visit this URL on like a 10-year-old flip phone with a rudimentary browser, I just get a basic HTML web page.
Hmm.
It functions, but it's simple.
Right. Exactly.
But if I visit that exact same URL on a modern smartphone, the browser reads the manifest, wakes up the service worker, establishes that secure connection, and suddenly unlocks all these advanced capabilities.
You nailed it.
I like to think of a PWA kind of like a digital transformer.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, like it starts out disguised as just a regular lightweight web page you clicked on from a Google search. But as the browser realizes what the device is capable of, the site shapeshifts.
Hmm.
It progressively gains these native superpowers until the user honestly can't even tell they're looking at a website.
That is exactly the intended illusion. And it brings us right back to those Starbucks and Pinterest statistics we mentioned.
Right.
By delivering this transformer-like experience, you completely eliminate the friction of the download.
But see, that brings up a massive contradiction for me.
How so?
Well, if a PWA is 99% smaller and it costs less to maintain, boosts engagement, and entirely sidesteps the whole App Store review process, which we know can be a nightmare.
Oh, absolutely.
Then why am I still downloading 500 megabyte apps to my phone? Like, if this is the holy grail, why isn't every single tech company ripping down their native apps today?
Because in software engineering, there are no silver bullets, right? Only trade-offs.
Okay, fair.
And the trade-offs here dictate an incredibly strict when to build versus when to walk away criteria. And you walk away from a PWA the moment your product requires deep, low-level device integration.
Like what specifically?
Okay.
What can a native app do that a service worker fundamentally can't?
Heavy background processing is a really big one. Also, advanced Bluetooth connectivity for IoT devices.
Mm.
Or complex augmented or virtual reality via the camera. Granular access to the user's local file system or their contacts.
So it's hardware stuff.
Exactly. For security and privacy reasons, web browsers heavily sandbox these capabilities. They do not give a web page even a progressive, one unfettered access to the hardware. So if your business model is like a fitness tracker that needs to sync via Bluetooth in the background while the phone is locked in your pocket?
A PWA is just not going to work.
It will aggressively fail you.
Okay, so if I'm building a heavy utility app or a massive 3D game, I stay native.
Yes.
But what about the business side of things? What about discovery? Because the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store are massive search engines in their own right.
They absolutely are.
So if I don't have an icon sitting in those stores, aren't I basically invisible to millions of users?
That is the exact counter-argument that many product managers make. And, to be fair, it is totally valid. If your entire growth strategy relies on organic discovery within the App Store ecosystem, skipping it is a massive risk.
So what do you do?
Well, the Scopic guide does note that you can use wrapper technologies.
Wrappers?
Yeah, things like Capacitor or PWO Builder or Trusted Web Activities for Android. These tools essentially take your PWA, wrap it in this really thin native shell, and let you publish it to the app stores.
Oh, so I get the best of both worlds then. I write the web code once, wrap it up, and boom, I'm in the app store.
Well, not exactly. I mean, you can do it, but you are introducing a ton of complexity.
How so?
The moment you introduce a wrapper, you are adding layers of potential bugs. You have to manage native SDK updates, and frankly, you subject yourself right back to the App Store review process that you are initially trying to avoid.
All right.
You lose the purity of the PWA model.
Which brings us to the elephant in the room. And here's where it gets really interesting for you listening. If a massive chunk of your user base is on iOS, isn't it an existential risk to build something that Apple actively suppresses? Let's be honest, Apple has historically treated PWAs like an unwanted guest, right?
They absolutely have, and it's for a very obvious business reason.
The 30% cut.
Exactly. Apple's App Store is a multi-billion dollar revenue engine. They take a huge cut of transactions. So a progressive web app operating purely on Safari bypasses that toll booth entirely. Consequently, Apple's support for modern web APIs has lagged significantly behind Google's Chrome.
So how does that friction actually manifest for the user holding an iPhone?
It primarily manifests in the installation process. So on an Android device, a PWA can trigger this really beautiful native-looking add-to-home screen prompt right at the bottom of the display.
Nice.
It takes one tap. But on an iPhone, Apple essentially hides that functionality.
Oh, of course they do.
Yeah. The user physically has to know to tap the Safari share icon, scroll down, find the add to home screen button, and confirm it. It is entirely unintuitive.
That's a lot of steps.
It is. And add to that the fact that iOS aggressively clears local web storage if a user hasn't visited your PWA in a few weeks.
Wait, really? It just deletes their saved data.
Yep. So you really start to see the friction there.
So if you're an engineering manager listening to this, how do you justify that? Why choose a tech stack that inherently frustrates half the phones in the room?
You justify it through the brutal math of user acquisition costs.
Okay, break that down.
Yes. A natively installed iOS app will yield higher deep engagement from the users who actually install it. But getting a user to leave what they're doing, go to the App Store, authenticate with Face ID, wait for a 200 megabyte download, and give up permanent storage space.
Yeah, that's a huge barrier.
That funnel is incredibly leaky. It costs an absolute fortune in marketing to get a single conversion. A PWA flips the funnel.
Because it's just a link.
Exactly. It dramatically lowers the friction to entry because it's just a hyperlink. You get an exponentially larger volume of users experiencing the core of your app instantly.
Right.
And that sheer volume of instant web-based access can effectively balance out the lower installation rates you see from those frustrated iOS users.
Okay, so you basically cast a significantly wider net at the top of the funnel. Let's say the engineering team makes a call. They've weighed the iOS trade-off, they don't need heavy Bluetooth access, and they really want that massive top-of-funnel web traffic.
Makes sense.
What does the physical architecture actually look like? Are we just writing standard HTML and CSS here?
Not for a modern PWA, no. You are generally looking at really robust JavaScript frameworks. React is incredibly popular, and it's often paired with Next.js. You also see a lot of Vue, Angular, and Svelte.
Now, I see Next.js brought up constantly in this context. Why pair React with Next.js, specifically for a PWA?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't the service worker handle all the speed once it's loaded?
The key phrase right there is once it's loaded.
Oh.
Yeah, a service worker needs time to wake up and intercept requests. If you just use plain React, the browser has to download a massive JavaScript bundle before it can render anything on the screen.
Which leaves the user staring at a blank white page.
Exactly, and that's terrible UX. But Next.js introduces server-side rendering, or SSR. It pre-builds the visual shell of the app on the server and sends down perfectly formed HTML instantly. So the user sees the app immediately, and then the service worker boots up in the background to take over the offline capabilities.
And what about hosting that server-side architecture?
For that, you need edge networks that natively support lightning-fast HTTPS globally.
Like who?
Platforms like Vercel, Netlify, Cloudflare Pages, AWS Amplify. These platforms are explicitly designed to push that initial application shell to servers geographically closest to the user.
That makes sense.
But the real heavy lifting of the PW, like the offline functionality, is heavily reliant on a specific toolset called Workbox.
Workbox?
Yeah, it simplifies the intensely complicated logic of caching.
Offline functionality. This is the part that feels like actual magic to me.
It really does.
Like loading a URL on a subway with zero cellular connection and having the app just function. But the Scopic guide waves a massive red flag here about something we should probably call the offline illusion.
Yes. This is so important. The quickest way to ruin a progressive web app is developer hubris.
Hubris.
Specifically, the assumption that because you can cache things for offline use, you should try to make the entire application work offline.
Right. It's like, okay, think about it like this. If I'm evacuating my house for a storm, I'm not going to try to pack my entire house into the trunk of my car.
Right.
I'm packing a survival go bag. I grab the essentials, the flashlight, the important documents, the water. In a PWA context, the go bag is the core layout.
Yeah.
The cached articles, maybe the user's dashboard.
Perfect analogy.
But I'm leaving the heavy multi-step checkout forms or the live customer support chat back at the house because those inherently require an active connection.
A go bag is the exact right framework for this. You cache the static assets locally so the app boots instantly, regardless of network conditions. But for dynamic real-time data, you implement a strategy called stale while revalidate.
Stale while revalidate. Break that down. What does that actually mean for the user?
It means when the user opens the app, the service worker instantly serves them the stale content from their go bag. So maybe that's a news feed from 3 hours ago.
Just so they have something to look at.
Exactly. So they have something to interact with immediately. But simultaneously, in the background, the service worker reaches out to the network to validate if there is new content. And if there is, it silently updates the interface.
But what if that background check fails? Like, what if they are totally offline in that subway tunnel?
This is where UX design absolutely makes or breaks the project. If a user is offline and they just see a generic browser dinosaur or a blank white screen, the developer has failed.
Totally.
A properly engineered PWA degrades gracefully. It clearly visually communicates to the user, hey, you are offline, but you can still read these 5 saved articles.
Oh, that's smart.
Even better, it allows for background sync. It lets the user type out a message or hit like on an article, stores that action in the go bag, and guarantees it will sync the microsecond the device reconnects to a cell tower.
Okay, so I've built a great offline go bag. The architecture is flawless.
Yeah.
But honestly, none of that matters if the user never actually installs the app in the first place.
True.
How do we get them to take that step without being completely obnoxious? Because I have to tell you, I am so sick of opening a web page just to read a single article and instantly getting hit with subscribe to notifications pop-up.
It's the worst.
It really is.
Yeah.
Why do developers still do this if the data clearly shows it drives users away?
They do it because they treat the development process like a technical checklist rather than a human journey. And this is arguably the most common pitfall outlined in the Scopic Guide.
The checkbox mentality.
Exactly. Developers pass a Google Lighthouse technical audit, they verify the service worker is active, and they immediately fire the prompt on page load. But they completely ignore the progressive part of progressive web app.
Right. There is nothing progressive about a pop-up screaming at me before the page even finishes rendering.
Exactly. You must wait for user intent.
User intent.
Yes. User intent is a measurable signal that the person actually finds value in your application. It's a user returning to the app for the third time in a week. It's successfully placing an e-commerce order. Or maybe it's tapping a button to save an itinerary.
So they're actually invested.
Right. When the user completes a meaningful action, that is the moment you introduce the prompt. Hey, would you like to save this app to your home screen for quicker access next time? Or do you want a push notification when this flight gets delayed?
Because at that point, you've actually earned the right to ask.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And the stakes here are incredibly high. If you blast a user with a notification prompt on their first visit and they click deny at the browser level, you are blocked.
Oh, permanently.
Practically, yes. They are never going into their buried iOS or Android settings to manually unblock you later. You burned the bridge before you even crossed it.
Wow. And, you know, the Scopic Guide points out a few other massive pitfalls that come from this kind of developer hubris. One that really caught my eye is the zombie app scenario regarding service worker updates. What exactly happens if a team mismanages the cache?
Oh, man. This is a terrifying scenario for a business.
It sounds bad.
It is. Remember, the service worker's entire job is to cache the application so it loads instantly. But if the engineering team doesn't build a robust update mechanism into the service worker lifecycle, the browser will fiercely hold on to that cached version.
Okay, so it just won't update.
Right. The business could push a massive update to their servers, like new pricing, new branding, maybe a critical security patch, and the user's service worker will just completely ignore it and keep serving the outdated local copy.
Oh, wow. So the user is looking at an application that essentially doesn't even exist anymore on your servers, wondering why the checkout is broken.
Yes. It becomes a zombie app. Managing the invalidation of that cache is, frankly, one of the most complex parts of maintaining a PWA.
I can imagine.
Which ties directly into another critical pitfall from the guide, measuring the wrong things.
Oh, let me guess.
Yeah.
Because if you treat a PWA like a native app, you're going to look for native app metrics, right?
Exactly. Executives want to see downloads and installs.
Right.
But tracking raw installation numbers for a PWA is a vanity metric. Mm-hmm. Many users will interact with your PWA entirely through the browser tab using all the rich features without ever clicking add to home screen.
Oh, interesting. So they are heavy users, but they don't count as an install.
Exactly. So if you measure success purely by installs, you'll think the project failed. You have to completely pivot your analytics to track time on site, return visits, and how frequently users are engaging with the offline or cached states.
This all boils down to an incredible amount of nuance. It's really not just a weekend coding project.
Not at all.
Which leads us to the reality check. If you're an engineering manager listening to this right now, and you need to pitch this transition to your CFO.
Yeah.
What is the actual logistical footprint? What are we talking about in terms of timeline and budget?
Well, according to the Scopic breakdown, for a moderately complex PWA that includes dynamic caching and secure integrations, you are looking at a 4 to 6 month development timeline.
Okay, 4 to 6 months. And the budget.
A baseline stripped down PWA might start around $20,000.
Okay.
But if you are building a highly customized enterprise-grade application with complex offline states and multiple system integrations, that budget scales rapidly from $50,000 to well over $200,000.
Wait, $200,000. Okay, pitching a $200,000 web project to a CFO is a notoriously tough sell.
Oh, absolutely.
How do you justify that ROI? Because to a non-technical executive, they are just hearing, we are paying $200,000 for a website.
You justify it by presenting the aggregate cost of the alternative, and the Microsoft Edge development team highlighted this perfectly.
What did they say?
If you want true cross-platform reach natively, you have to build an iOS app with Swift, an Android app with Kotlin, and a separate web platform.
Oh, all right.
You are maintaining three entirely independent code bases, managed by three specialized development teams, navigating three different release cycles.
So that $200,000 PWA is actually buying you three code bases for the price of one.
Exactly. The upfront cost might seem steep, but the long-term maintenance costs absolutely plummet. When an API changes, you update the central PWA codebase once, and it propagates to desktop, Android, and iOS instantly.
That makes a lot of sense. But to execute that, I imagine you can't just hand the project off to a standard web design agency.
Definitely not.
The Scopic Guide puts a really heavy emphasis on vetting the right development partner. So if I'm leading this initiative, what is the ultimate litmus test for an agency?
It really comes down to testable URLs.
Testable URL.
Yes. Do not hire a development partner based on beautiful Figma mockups or polished screenshots. You need to ask for the URLs of PWAs they've actually pushed to production.
Okay.
Open those URLs on your own phone, force your phone into airplane mode, and see what happens.
Ah. Does the go bag actually work, or does the whole thing collapse into a dinosaur screen?
Exactly. And furthermore, you need a partner who has real opinions. If they simply say yes when you ask them to make your massive video library available offline, they are a bad partner.
They're just yes men.
Right. They need to push back, they need to deeply understand the iOS walled garden, and they absolutely must prioritize raw performance metrics like Google's core web vitals.
Because at the end of the day, a slow PWA is just a bad website.
Exactly.
We have covered incredible ground today. We started by dissecting the underlying architecture, you know, how HTTPS and the web app manifest set the stage for the service worker to act as a proxy brain, transforming a simple hyperlink into fully native feeling software.
Yep. And we navigated the harsh realities of the trade-off.
We did.
Acknowledging that while PWAs lose the deep hardware integration and have to battle Apple's clunky installation friction, they massively widen the top of the acquisition funnel.
And we broke down the developer hubris that ruins these apps. The absolute necessity of packing an offline go bag rather than trying to hoard the whole house.
Right.
And the psychology of waiting for genuine user intent before pushing notifications.
It really requires a delicate balance of high-level engineering and, you know, deep empathy for the user's context.
It really does. It's not just about what the code can do. It's about how the user experiences that transition from web to app.
Exactly. And if we connect this all to the bigger picture, it raises a thought I want you, the listener, to walk away with today.
Let's hear it.
If progressive web apps continue to mature, blurring the line entirely between a simple URL and fully functional software, what does the long-term future hold for traditional app stores?
Oh, that's a huge question.
Right. If developers no longer need a corporate intermediary to host, review, or approve their software, think about how that might eventually shift the balance of power. We could be looking at a future where software distribution moves away from the massive tech gatekeepers and firmly back into the hands of the decentralized open web.
That is a phenomenal point to end on. A return to the true open web, where power resides in a single, shareable link rather than a walled garden. To everyone listening, keep questioning the architecture of the technology you interact with every single day. The more you understand how the invisible proxy layers and cache systems operate, the better equipped you are to navigate where the digital world is heading. Until next time, keep exploring.